Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:50 in that specific summer time. Well, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And if we, I guess the main point this week has been that we've had really quite extraordinary volatility in government bond markets, that the euro has got all the way just about all the way up to test the region of the moving average and is pulling back from that area, that the Chinese stock market, having consolidated for much of the month, is breaking out to the upside from what has been a relatively similar sized consolidation to that we saw back between December and the end of February. And this week also we saw gold pulling back from the $1,225 area. Well, let's attempt to put some of that into context. If we start with currencies, one of the things that's most important is that a lot of investors became really quite complacent about where currencies were likely to trade in the decade from about 2000 onwards. The dollar had entered a period of time when it was really just getting weaker, just month by month. Well, that is now over. That when we look at the dollar index, so I don't particularly like looking at the dollar index because it's almost identical to the euro dollar, that the euro represents, I think, about 55% of the index, and the yen is the other big component. I don't think you learn an awful lot from looking at the dollar, the dollar index, because it's really just one currency pair. But when you start to look at others in conjunction with the dollar index, take a look at, for example, the Asian dollar index, the Latin American dollar index, and there's a really good one that the Fed produces. They don't update it particularly often. It's called the Other Important Trading Partners Index. We have them all in the chart library. But when you start looking at them and you look at them in terms of commonality, well, commonality is something that we really focus on at the chart seminar, because in our service, it's really where we get some of our best calls. When we see a sector, whether that is when one looks at currencies, bonds, equities, or commodities, when you see that a sector is turning to outperformance and that there's a large number of the constituents in that sector are doing the same thing, well, then it's pretty much money in the bank that there is a theme there that is worthy of further investigation. And if we can identify what it is, we have a clue as to what is really motivating investors. Well, when you start to string together various currency pairs and various currency indices, you come up with this dollar strength. It isn't that the dollar is getting strong against the euro. Obviously, the euro is one of the weaker currencies around at the present time, but it's not that the dollar is only strengthening against the weakest currency in the world. The dollar is appreciating versus a whole basket of different currencies. And, well, why would that be? Well, no country wants a strong currency. The real question is, how long is any country willing to tolerate a strong currency for? And there are some countries need a weak currency more than others. Well, the Europeans definitely need a weaker currency in here at the moment. Japan needs a weaker currency. China has so far foregone the temptation to devalue its currency. It's attempting to go the internal... it's attempting to do what Europe did. Europe tried to go through the internal readjustment process and then had to resort to weakening the currency when that didn't work. China's attempting to go through this reorganization process internally, and they still have the door open to them to devalue their currency at some point in the future, but there's no sign of that yet. Well, the Australians need a weaker currency, and what we're seeing is that the US is not the country that needs the weakest currency in the world any longer. That wage growth is starting to improve, that the labor market has certainly improved, unemployment has come down. People aren't yet happy with the pace of the expansion. The wealth effect has been concentrated among investors rather than savers. That's certainly been the case. But by and large, the economy in the USA is doing better than just about anywhere else, and that's important. Certainly, it's a fundamental case for being bullish of the dollar, and the dollar continues to represent a currency which has been going down for 10 years and is now appreciating. Exactly what that's going to do in terms of labor competitiveness in the years ahead is very much an open question, because we're starting to see wage growth and dollar appreciation. Well, that then means that the argument for automation, the argument for having robots do as much of as many jobs as is, I was going to say humanly possible, but of course that's not the point. It's that robots can do as many jobs as is mechanically possible. We're getting to a point where the pace not only of robotics itself, but the software architecture and the sensors that they require are all improving at such a rapid pace that the pace of automation is going to increase and increase substantially over the next decade. And that's all good news, because human beings are demanding more wages, and they're doing it in an appreciating currency within the USA. Well, Japan and the US are likely to lead in terms of automation. Europe probably won't be far behind. They also have their own robotics companies and very able programmers. And well, this is something that we're going to have to see exactly how it all plays out for the higher population, higher growth type of economies. They now need to improve governance. If governance was important before, governance is going to not only be important, but it's going to be progressively more important as we move into more of a digital age and an age with which we are competing with robots and artificial intelligence for work. It means that the structure of the economy, the structure of the political framework, and a clear line for deregulation and allowing the market to shape itself is going to require some very inventive ways of structuring economies. Well, without it, we're going to have the kinds of environment that you currently have today, because commodity prices are coming down. It's hardly a surprise that the amount of unrest that we're now seeing in the Middle East is in inverse correlation to the price of oil. That things were not nearly as, the unrest that we're seeing now wasn't really a factor when oil prices were high. I don't generally tend to write an awful lot about geopolitical events unless that they have the potential to have a major effect on markets. And personally, I'm watching what's happening in Yemen at the present time very closely. The reason for that is that Syria is incredibly important, Iraq is incredibly important, but Saudi Arabia is engaged in a land war in Yemen. And so far, they haven't made any great inroads. Well, this is a new administration there. This is a 20-something-year-old defense minister with absolutely no experience. And within 3 months of getting the job, he's gone off to war already. Well, you know, that's not usually a recipe for success. And the potential there for unrest to have an impact on the oil price is non-trivial and is something that really does need to be paid attention to. Well, we don't have any, this isn't a short-term consideration, this would be more of a medium to longer-term consideration. But what we're seeing is that it is now becoming increasingly clear that you can differentiate countries where governance is improving and where governance is regressing. It doesn't matter what level governance is coming from, provided that the trajectory of that governance is improving, then that's generally good for the economy and generally good for markets. And from the perspective of a foreign investor, it's generally good news that you might, having made the investment, actually be able to realize the investment and take some of the money back at some point in the future. That, I guess, in our household, we often have the conversation about the role of democracy. And democracy isn't the necessary ingredient in order to get economic growth and markets. What you often need is respect for minority shareholder interests and an independent judiciary. Well, those are generally the kinds of things that you get in later in the cycle, but that generally what you're looking for is the trajectory to be moving in that direction. Well, when we start to look around the world, then you can differentiate the countries where things are getting better and things are getting worse. Well, India is an example of a country where things are very definitely getting better and coming off of a very, very low base. And they absolutely need to do that. That they have this potential here, that they have a demographic dividend, that they have incredibly low labor costs, and they have the potential to build a vibrant manufacturing center. Well, China is at the other side of the equation, where it has the infrastructure and it has an aging and more expensive workforce, where GDP per capita is now approximately $7,000. Well, it's considerably less than that in India. China is moving into a more mechanistic approach. They're trying to develop a consumer-led economy. They've already gone into the middle-income tier per capita, and they're looking to become a developed economy. And they're already outsourcing the cheaper manufacturing to neighboring countries. India has the potential to become one of the region's major manufacturing centers. That we're going to see in the next decade a delineation between the types of jobs that people can do cheaper than robots, or where a robot is simply going to represent too much of a cost to get the thing done. I would say that, you know, in the garment industry, you're probably still going to have people sewing individual garments. That hasn't changed in any way at all over the last decades, whereas the types of people that will be displaced will be in the service sector. You're already seeing that waiters are being trimmed down on, that there is a restaurant in just about every corner of almost every street in Southern California, and they're already trimming down their waiting staff. Well, it means then that we are presented with the potential that productivity per worker is going to improve. That if you replace a worker with a robot, and that robot is doing at least the work of one person, then the productivity of the remaining person and the productivity per worker is going to improve. Well, this is really very important. When we look at the potential that there is, could potentially be a secular bull market, well, governance has got to be integral to that. We're at a position at the present time where people are often expressing anxiety, not least because the market has been rallying for nearly 6 years. Well, when Janet Yellen was talking today and saying that the Fed was getting ready to raise interest rates, but they were waiting until the labor market is at full capacity, it strikes me as odd. It really is a testament to just where we are in terms of this cycle and how different it is to cycles we've seen previously. Generally speaking, the Fed starts raising interest rates well before the labor market is at full capacity. They're already well into their tightening cycle by the time the labor market is at full capacity, and often they have already we've already seen an inverted yield curve by the time labor is generally the thing that moves last. So you wouldn't be waiting for the lagging indicator to start to improve before raising interest rates. But that is exactly what they're doing. And of course, the reason they're doing that is because the market is totally addicted to liquidity. That the pace of corporate bond issuance is at all-time highs. The pace of covenant light debt issuance is at all-time highs, way in excess of where we were in 2007. And if you remember in 2008 and 2009, people saying we're never going to do that again, well, that didn't last long. The central bank printing money with abandon makes any sort of risk look appealing, particularly when yields are at risible levels and the number of people that are expecting to get a payout from their pensions is only going to increase over the next 20 years. We just don't know what's going to happen when interest rates start to rise. But when you think about the correlations, that there has been this correlation between the S&P 500 and the Fed's balance sheet. The S&P moved to a new all-time high this week. It's pretty much unchanged in here today. The Nasdaq was pretty much unchanged in here today. But what we also saw was that the Fed's balance sheet has also has been going sideways for the last 4 or 5 months. There was the two almost moved in lockstep for the last 4 or 5 years. It's hardly surprising then that with the Fed's balance sheet stagnating with the end of quantitative easing, that the S&P is having a little bit more of a difficult time moving or advancing. Well, then we have to say that if you look at where the market has been reacting and how people have been trading, that this is still a liquidity-fueled environment. The quantitative easing has two major effects, that it depresses currencies and it inflates asset prices. Well, the Fed has stopped its quantitative easing program, and that has fed through to inflating the value of the currency. The ECB is really only just getting started. They tried to go through the internal reorganization, and by doing that, they engendered a deflationary environment that really scared them. So they have now embarked upon a re-expansion of their balance sheet. They're going to add $1 trillion between March of this year and September of next year, and they've really only just begun. Well, it means that Europe today is like what we saw in Japan about 2.5 years ago, that the Japanese have started devaluing their currency. The trend in the expansion of the Bank of Japan's balance sheet is just a straight line up. They're continuing to print with abandon. At the beginning, that was a nominal price inflation in terms of asset prices. What you're now seeing is that the earnings are starting to come through. The benefits of having a sharply devalued currency are starting to accrue to the export sector. They're gaining increased competitiveness relative to their global counterparts, and the stock market is starting to fire on all cylinders. Well, the Nikkei went through 20,000 in here this week. That's important, not only because it's going through this big psychological level, but because it's broken the long-term progression of lower rally highs. We can now say that this is a new, potentially secular bull market for Japan. Well, Europe is lagging Japan by about 3 years. They've only just begun their quantitative easing program. It's going to take probably 8 or 9 months before the benefits of having a sharply weaker currency accrue to the balance sheets of European exporters. And at that point, then, the stock market will take off and start to perform not only in nominal terms, but on a currency-adjusted basis. If you currency-adjust the stock 600 and look at it in terms of the US dollar, well, then it really hasn't gone anywhere. But you've had a very spectacular rally in terms of the nominal price performance. It's really exactly what you saw in Japan. Well, a sharply weaker euro, and the euro this week pulled back from the 115 area, and it's at 110, and just a little bit of change in here at the present moment. Well, that's unwound the majority of the oversold condition. And, well, we might see some additional ranging in this region, but that the chances of it going very much above the 115 area are looking increasingly unlikely. That having begun to devalue the currency and begun the quantitative easing, the ECB can't very well stop now. It would be extraordinarily rash for them to declare that they had declare a victory after only 3 months of easing. When you start to look at just how much money there is, you take the balance sheets of the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and the Bank of China, combine them all and rebase them to US dollars, you come up with a number of about 15 trillion, which is on an expansionary trajectory. Therefore, when we look at the liquidity situation, that there is no shortage of it, that liquidity is both mobile and global, and that it goes to the assets that have got the best potential for outperformance or the best potential for yield or currency appreciation. In this year, what we're seeing is that Europe is catching up with the rest of the world, that Japan continues to outperform, and China is really only just now beginning to join the party, that they've been on a tightening bias for the last 4 years and are really only now starting to lower interest rates. Well, lowering interest rates and encouraging people back into the stock market and giving the policy green light from officialdom has resulted in really quite a spectacular breakout for China. And it had some of, well, before it started rallying, it had some of the most attractive valuations on earth. Well, the Chinese have the potential that they could succeed in their reorganization, and if that's the case, then there won't be any need for a crash in terms of asset prices, or they're going to fail in terms of their organization, in which case there will be a property crash, and then they will devalue the renminbi. Generally speaking, the renminbi is a cheap currency to hedge against at the present moment, that with China rallying so spectacularly and the renminbi being pretty inert, then there is no currency risk. It's not like Europe or it's not like Japan a few years ago, where the devaluing currency really represented a threat to total return from the perspective of a foreign investor, that you absolutely had to hedge. Well, at the present moment, hedging the renminbi, considering that it doesn't really go up very much, and that there is the potential that if things do not work out, that then it would be a cheap hedge at the present moment. Obviously, when any currency is devalued, it's following the devaluation that things really start to pick up, and that was certainly the case for India. Well, the Indian market has had the big breakout, it had it last year, and it spent most of the year this year in the process of mean reversion, so it is noteworthy this week that India found support in the region of the moving average, that the rupee is back towards the 64 area and has at least steadied. And well, this is exactly what we were looking for, that you were looking for a process of mean reversion following the big breakout, and well, we've had that now. Then, provided it holds the recent lows around 8,000 on the Nifty, then we can probably continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. When we think about the potential that there is going to be a secular bull market because of productivity growth, what's that productivity growth going to be predicated on? Well, it'll have to be predicated on improving governance. It'll have to be predicated on real growth in terms of the economies. Well, what is the kind of thing that will generate that growth? Well, certainly the fact that energy prices have come down. Energy prices have, well, Brent crude has fallen from approximately 140 to 120, from 120 earlier on this year to the high 40s, and is now back around $65. We don't yet know at what point the price is really going to run into trouble, but that it's down a dollar in here today, that it's unwound the oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. And what we've been looking for the last 5 years has been that the unconventional oil and gas boom would be a game changer for the energy sector, and that's now in the price. It doesn't make a lot of sense to continue to talk about it being a game changer. It's already a game changer. It's already resulted in this massive decline. When we start to think about what's going to happen next, well, we can go back and look at history. And we have this great chart in the library, OILPHIST, and it goes back to 1880. And if you look at that on a log scale and look at all the data we have, then you're presented with the cyclicality in the oil market, that it goes sideways for decades and then has explosive breakouts. Well, we've had the explosive breakout and now we're into this, what could potentially be a very lengthy range. We're still more or less rallying from the lower side of that range. We don't know where the upper side is likely to be. But the most likely scenario is that the upper side is below $100. Once we see the rig count starting to turn around, that'll be an indication that the price has risen enough to encourage new supply back into the market. And that will give us the upper side of what is potentially going to be that long range. Well, it means then that we're going to be back in an oil price situation pretty similar to what we had in the 80s and 90s, that you do get occasional spikes to the upside, but that they're spikes, that it's not a new secular bull market. And it really means that the first really big downward dynamic on oil is likely to mark a peak of at least near-term significance, and that the likelihood of a retest of the low near $50 is going to become progressively more likely. There is the possibility that oil prices do what natural gas prices did. Natural gas prices have never recovered following the spike that we had around Hurricane Rita. That natural gas prices today are really not that much higher than they were in the decade before the bull market. So, and that is a direct result of unconventional oil and gas. Well, what's going to happen next? Well, Tesla is by far the most high-profile company that's producing home batteries. It's not the only company, but it's certainly the most high-profile one. But perhaps more important than that is that almost none of us have a home battery today. Well, renewable energy has long been expensive, but also has been plagued by inconsistency, in that you don't get solar energy when the sun is not shining. You certainly don't get it at night. You don't get wind energy when the wind is not blowing. But if you have industrial size batteries, that, or you have batteries that are designed for the home, and solar cells become increasingly efficient, well, the simple point about solar is that it is a technology, and as because it's not an extractive resource, then it is that Moore's law is applicable, that they're getting progressively more efficient and they're getting progressively cheaper to manufacture. But you start to couple them with batteries, then you are able to not only sell your excess energy back onto the grid, but that you're able to save your energy, that you can charge your car with it, you can power your home with it, you can heat your water and your living space with it. Well, that's then going to turn this into a very different scenario for energy. That oil isn't exactly except for a very small number of places in the world, it's not the kind of fuel that's used for power generation. But it is a transport fuel. And the build-out of the electric car sector is looking progressively more likely. Well, obviously, what we would like to see is some of the range issues dealt with and the quality of the build to improve and the cost to come down. Certainly, the companies are being giving a helping hand, not least by China, where the Chinese are introducing progressively more stringent laws that they're going to require more electric cars on the road. Well, since China is by far the largest market for cars and the biggest growth market for cars, that whatever it is works there will become more dominant elsewhere as well. That doesn't necessarily mean that the electric cars necessarily have to get better or cheaper, but that they're going to get a helping hand from regulation. When you start coupling an electric car with efficient solar cells and a domestic battery, then the impact on demand for gasoline will move into what could potentially be a secular decline. That's not in the price. That's not really being considered at the present moment. that when you still read energy reports, there's nobody talking about that as a potential possibility. And yet, when one looks at the technology, that would, I think, probably have to be one of the base cases. And that's going to contribute to a lengthy ranging environment for oil. Well, if you have lower energy prices and you have productivity growth from technology and you have more people reaching their productive capacity as a result of improving governance, then you have the conditions for what could be a very big secular bull market. And if we just go back and look at the cyclicality of markets, then the argument that we could be in the throes of the beginning of a secular bull market is justified by the price action. That over the last 100 years, the S&P has gone through secular bull and bear markets, and that the bear markets have generally been these very lengthy ranging phases. And when you get a breakout, then that breakout goes faster and farther than anyone has been expecting, because they've been conditioned by the bear market that you may get some sort of deeper pullback or a first step above the base, but that once the big breakout has occurred, that prices appreciate on a sustained basis for years and years. And the S&P broke out 18 months ago. We don't know yet what's going to happen in terms of yields. We don't know yet what's going to happen in terms of short-term interest rates. What we do know is that the quantity of bonds has increased substantially. And think then another way. If it were a stock market, and the stock market had been rallying for decades, and the supply of equities had increased substantially, and yet their liquidity in those markets was deteriorating because people were buying the new issues and not selling, that everyone was holding on for longer because they anticipated prices to continue to go up forever. It's exactly what you anticipate happening, that in a euphoric state, that people want to buy in a hurry and are very slow to sell. Then they withdraw their supply from the market and prices rise until they meet an offer. That's how a bull market continues to appreciate. It attracts progressively more buyers, and those buyers don't want to sell. Of course, just I guess the way I've always thought about it was in terms of Hegel's master-slave dialectic. Eventually, all of that pent-up supply becomes the unsated demand becomes potential supply. All of the people that have been buying and not selling become potential sellers. What we're seeing at the present moment is that liquidity within the bond markets has deteriorated. It's deteriorated for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is because of new rules that have been introduced for the big banks, that they can't have these big trading operations, that they have to hold more bonds and that their position sizes are smaller. We also see that insurance companies have to have these a larger percentage of tier one assets, and that means that they have to hold bonds and that it becomes expensive not to hold them. And we also know that there was a record inflow of investors into long-dated bonds in January when they went to a new all-time low. Well, we've had a fairly substantial rally since then. And if one looks at the long-term chart, you can't but conclude that volatility has increased. That we are, it looks increasingly like that this is a developing type 3 bottom, ranging time and size. That we've just had a failed downside break. Well, a failed downside break with a big upper dynamic suggests that we're going to test the upper side of the range, and that's about 4% on the 30-year. That also happens to be where the progression of lower rally highs is for the 34-year bull market. So, in the short term, there's the potential for yields to go higher. And in the medium term, there's the potential that that progression of lower rally highs is going to get tested and potentially broken. Well, if it breaks it, then the potential is that because this hasn't been an accelerated decline, because the complacency within the market is such that it is, that we could have an explosive breakout, that if they go through 4%, they could be at 6% in a very short period of time. Well, if that happens, that's going to have a knock-on effect for just about everything. That the bond markets and the currency markets are multiples larger than the equity markets. And if you look at treble B yields and you look at double B yields, what you're presented with are base formations, that borrowing costs are not going any lower, and that there is a wall of debt that needs to be refinanced in the period from about 2017-18 onwards. So there's nothing that has to be refinanced in 2015. There's nobody worried about that. But we know where the potential for issues is likely to be. And that's why we have to monitor the consistency of trends. And I guess in many respects, we're lucky, because what we're presented with have been highly consistent trends. And therefore, they're easy to monitor. That we had a bigger pullback in October. We continue to see that the progression of higher reaction lows continues to hold. There is the potential that the bigger pullback we had last October was a penultimate high, that it was an inconsistency within what had been a previously consistent trend. We don't have any evidence yet of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend endings. We won't have that until the progression of higher reaction lows is broken, or we get an outsized acceleration away from where we are right now. But because we're presented with these consistent trends, they're going to be easier to monitor. If we see the progression of higher reaction lows broken, the potential for us to move into a more volatile, rangy environment and consolidation of what has been an incredibly powerful breakout will increase fairly substantially. On Wall Street, the potential for Europe to get back up and test the 2007 and 2000 highs on the stocks 600 is looking progressively more likely, and that will be contingent on the euro continuing to devalue. But we're certainly living in exciting times. Well, there's a lot of people looking at all of this happening and then thinking about, well, what's going to happen next with gold? That the price has come from about $1,900 down to $1,200, and there is the gold price this week pulled back from about 1,225. Well, in addition to being a sort of a round number, 1,225 is also the region of the 200-day moving average and the progression of lower rally highs. And it really does need to get above that level. It needs to get above 1,225 to demonstrate that demand is returning to dominance beyond the short term. What we have seen, though, is that gold shares are doing a bit better, that gold prices, I guess, have been really quite steady, that they've been ranging between about $1,150 and $1,300 for much of the last 2 years. And that's against a background where oil prices fell really very dramatically. With prices around $1,200, gold miners, having gone through massive processes of rationalization, are back to their cheapest level relative to the gold price since 2001. And in this environment, they're doing rather well, not least as energy prices have come down. Well, I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend. I wish all the best to all of you.